calling you out for your white friend quota, and your response is,
I got a checklist of white friends.
So your white friend quota is good.
Oh, it's good. I don't need any more white friends. It's all checked off. This is
you might have just ostracized, 85% of your Twitter following by that, right? There's somebody out there that's like, ooh.
They're sad because I don't need any more white friends.
Right. You know, it's like that. It's, the whole, sorry, that's not blasting. Your white following might have just took a bruising with that statement.
You and I, the on-ramp was pretty deep today.
If I can speak on their behalf, the white folks will be okay.
Okay.
We'll be okay.
You'll be okay because you're still going to be able to enjoy the fruit of the white supremacy labor. You're still going to enjoy the fruits of those labors, whether you know it or not. So this is season 4, episode 21 of the Decoded Podcast, and we're coming in hot. We're talking racism. We're talking racism right off the get-go here. Clough, are you racist?
Yes.
Guess what? I'm racist too, unfortunately. But the positive aspect of that is that I'm learning.
Shape that. Yeah. Okay. There we go.
I'm learning. And I'm working on becoming an anti-racist.
Yes.
So that when I'm experiencing something or I'm in the middle of something and I make a decision or I have a thought, I think about my decision, I think about my thought, and I analyze whether it is racist or not. And then I go from there. I have a really, really good story that I didn't tell you. In the on-ramp, and because just the way we were talking, it just wasn't going to come out. But
yep.
So I grew up in Ottawa, and I was born and raised in a not such a great part of town. And then my parents bought a house in a better area, better neighborhood. We moved there. And my cousins, they grew up in a not so favorable part of Ottawa. And I remember as a kid, we would go visit my cousins weekly in this neighborhood. And I played outside in the neighborhood. My cousins and I ran around in the neighborhood and we never thought anything of it. Mm-hmm. Never anything of it. And then we get to university days and I meet a guy who becomes a good friend of mine. And, typical university student, no money, doing everything he can to, conserve the money he has, mm-hmm. eating, just typical poor university student, right, from Toronto.
Yep.
So I get to know him, and I'm like, dude, we got this huge project. I'm going to need help. Can we work together? He's like, 100%. Why don't you come to my place? I live in this house. I'm in the basement. Come to my place. We'll start working on this thing together. I said, right on. Gives me his address. And I literally was like, you live where? And he's like, yeah, that's where I live. And I'm like, dude, did anybody... And this guy's no nonsense. I'm like, did anybody tell you about this area? He's like, what are you talking about? He goes, I came to Ottawa with my parents. We needed a place. We found this place. The price is good. The roommates seem nice. I get the whole basement. The guy was living in the heart of the hood, the heart, not on the outskirts of it, right in the middle of it. And here's the best part. That's where my cousins grew up. And now, as a university student, I'm thinking, I can't go there. I had to seriously rethink. I stopped and I was like, Roland, what is your problem? You spent your whole childhood there. And I remember telling my mom, I'm going to my buddy's house to do work. Guess where he lives, mom? She's like, where? So I tell her, literally 5 units away from where my cousins grew up. And she's like, oh, okay, well, we'll see you when you get home. She didn't even think twice about it because that's where her sister and her nieces and nephews grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget going to his place and, parking my Honda Accord outside in the parking lot or whatever. I was like, when did this shift happen to me? When did this shift happen where I became I don't even know what the word is. I shifted my thinking about this particular area because of what you see on the news and what people say here and what people say there. Yet this great guy is living here. I'm here to work with him. I spent my whole childhood in this neighborhood. So what am I, where did the fear come from and how did it grow? And the fear, you know, there were white people in that neighborhood, but there were lots of people of color and different cultures and ethnicities. And it was funny because that's where they went, because that was where there was availability and the price was right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and that's why my buddy ended up there. And I just wanted to share that because I was saying to you that over the years, there are some white people. That's not fair. I shouldn't say that. There are people who are enjoying the fruits of the white supremacy labor. And I have too enjoyed those fruits. Because I was telling you, we were talking about, you know, for me, it's low-hanging fruit when someone says, I'm not racist because I have a black friend, or I'm not racist because I know a couple of people who are people of color and I can call them my buddy. So I'm not racist. That's low-hanging fruit for me. If you don't want to be a racist, and I think those people don't even care. They don't want to be anything but what they are, right? Yeah. So whether they're racist or not, they like, if they're racist, they're not changing, especially if they're like, well, I got one black friend, so I'm good. I can still think things that are, you know, racially heated, and I can believe certain things about certain people because that's just what I believe. But I got a black friend. We know now, you and I, from the readings we've done, I'm not going to even speak for you. I know from the readings I've done and kind of the things I've read about and researched that a good movement, a good place to be right now is if you don't like enjoying the fruits of the white supremacy labor without thinking about it first, and you have one black friend, but you don't think you're a racist, but you'd like to change maybe, or you'd like to expand your thinking and your reflection, then to consider what it means to be an anti-racist is a great way to start. You know, what does that look like? What does it mean to be anti-racist? And ever since reading Dr. Kendi's book, Stamped from the Beginning, The History of Racism in America, it's opened my eyes. And you know, have I become a better person? I wouldn't say that, but I would say that I'm more aware of my racist thoughts, my racist actions, how I have benefited from the fruits of the white supremacy labor, because I have. And I always think back to when I was a kid, my father was teaching me about the world and how to be, because I remember sharing with my dad that kids made fun of me for what I ate. Kids made fun of me for how I looked. Kids made fun of me for how I dressed. And all those things were connected somehow to me being Middle Eastern. The food, the clothing, like those things were all, they were part of my parents' schema around how they grew up as Middle Eastern people. Mm-hmm. And I would share that I was, you know, being teased or whatever. And my father, he would always, right from the beginning, no, you're a Canadian. Don't let them tell you you're not. You are one of them. You know, a true believer in the whole multiculturalism movement, my dad would be like, no, you're one of them. You're one of them. You can eat what you want to eat, but you are Canadian. You were born here. You're growing up here. You're going to school here. We value this Canadian culture. So you are Canadian. But as I got older, my father directly and indirectly would kind of give me tips on how to navigate the system, if you will. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I learned that when I'm sitting in a room full of powerful people who tended to be white, you keep your mouth shut and you do what you're told. You don't push back.
Damn, can I just, the whole, like, the way you almost frame that made me think about the implications of feeling like you're accidentally white. Oh my God, like that's just like your, you know, even your words saying about these spaces that tended to be white. I'm like flipping the idea. I'm like, yeah, you know what the counter thinking is? The counter thinking is that this whole thing is because you're accidentally white, that somehow you're in a space where, you know, if that you're not necessarily obligated to do anything about because you're there accidentally white, as opposed to realizing like you are the system. Like you don't get to be accidentally white. You don't get to be sort of like not a part of that exact same system. You don't get to sit in the room and sort of think to yourself, well, you know, how much can I do? Because these groups tend to be all white. Man, sorry to jump in, but that was just like, because I think that's the counter. No, I'm not sorry I jumped in. I do apologize for abruptly jumping in, but I had to throw that in there. Being accidentally white is a messed up mindset, but I think I'm starting to see the power of that thinking and how it creates inertia.
And you see now how when I need to rethink things that I in the way I operate, because sometimes I'm racist and I don't even know it because it feels normal. It feels normal based on my existence. So, you know, my father would say, "Don't worry. There's always going to be people who push back against the system. Don't be the one, especially if you're there trying to get what you need to move on." So my dad would be like, he'd be like, "Yeah, okay. So immerse your. Okay, so what do you want to do? What do you want to gain? What do you want to accomplish? Right? Figure that out, and then figure out the path you need to take to get there. And once you know the path, if it's going to lead you," now he didn't say this, but this is now kind of what I'm able to put together of what he said. "If it's going to lead you down the roads of the white supremacy fields where they're growing their fruit, then know how to operate in those fields. Know how to navigate down that path." That's what my dad was saying. He's saying, "You can push back all you want, but you want to get a bachelor's degree? You need to go to university and you need to play by their rules. You want to get a master's degree, then you need to figure out how to apply to a master's degree and follow their you need to code switch to be able to give them what it is that they're looking for so that they say you're one of us." Right? Now, so that's kind of become part of my operating system. So, and you know this, like this is going to sound really weird, but I truly realized how racist I've become from the work that I'm currently doing in the school that I'm in now, that is predominantly people of color, overwhelmingly black and people of color, overwhelmingly. Only now do I realize everything's coming into place, right? The readings I'm doing, the people I'm talking to, the reflecting, the being open to saying that I'm a racist, that I have been racist, that I have racist thinking in me. I think we all do, but people won't admit it. I'm okay to admit it right now here with you. I mean, if I'm walking down the street and Joe says, "Hey, I heard the podcast, you're a racist," I'd probably look at Joe and be like, "Why are you calling me a racist?" Like it won't sit well. It won't sit right at that moment in time because of the context. But where I'm working now and the readings I'm doing, the people I'm talking to, and the things popping up all over the place about diversity and equity, it's got me thinking in different ways. And I guess I am a product of the system I came through. And, you know, my dad told me to blend in. My dad said, "You're okay. You're Canadian. Do what you need to do to get the job done." And I do use that. I do use that to benefit me now. And code switching can be really bad, but it can also be really good. And I unfortunately use it a lot and understand it. I think, well, I understand it good enough that I'm sitting where I'm sitting here today, right? I have an education. I have a job. I can talk to many different people. So anyway, that's where we're at. So white supremacy and the fruits of their labor. Do we enjoy the fruits? Do we even know that they're there sitting in front of us? I don't know. I know you and I both know white people who appear to be enjoying the fruits of the white supremacy labor. Now, they're not, they may not call themselves white supremacists. They might not call themselves racist, but they are certainly, if I've enjoyed the fruits of the labor, then certainly those white people have enjoyed the fruits of the labor. Certainly. Come on.
Yeah, I think that when I try to dig into my process of becoming an anti-racist, I don't know if I've ever thought to myself that I have that the process of sort of becoming an anti-racist is somehow, it's kind of weird the way these words are coming together. I don't think for me, I've put a prerequisite on the process of becoming anti-racist as something that I should be able to say I'm becoming a better person. I think I got to work through those words, because I almost feel as if, not almost, I do feel that by saying my process of becoming an anti-racist makes me feel good is kind of counter to what I should actually be producing in the world. If I feel like by putting the fact that I feel good about the work that I'm doing to become better at being anti-racist, because it doesn't sit in a natural space for me. I'm aware of my own work. I'm aware of when my brain pushes back and starts to sort of go, but that, you know, should you say this thing right now? Like, to sort of measure the moments as I'm sort of in groups, in white groups, in equity groups, and topics pop up or activities pop up where this group is trying to move in the direction of being anti-racist. I find more and more the moments where we're sort of centering our own emotions of sort of happiness and growth, like ours as the individuals that are doing the work. I guess I've seen the posts, and I'll say on socials, I've seen the posts from, you know, the white followers, my social media crew, that sort of like Privileged Learning Network. Maybe that's a better PLN word. The Privileged Learning Network. I've seen where the posts are designed in such a way, intentionally or otherwise, but the design of them are using that trope of this work makes me feel good, and that gets put before the this work is effective. And I think part of, I go back to an example. I can remember my daughter. So doing pickup with my daughter from daycare, both of my kids had daycare in the exact school that they went to. It was awesome, right? Like, that's any parent out there, if you can actually get the childcare in the school where your kids go, like, that's just sweet. And I wish that happiness on everybody as a parent. Doesn't always happen, I get it. But it was really, really cool. Mostly because, first I have to start because of the privilege of being able to do that. I had childcare in the same school that my kids went to school. I could afford childcare. The next layer after that, that I really still have a deep appreciation, is my daughter and I walking down the hallway after childcare. And again, this was a hallway. The childcare was in the exact same space for the entire stretch that both of my kids were in there. And it was maybe in grade three or four, where we're walking down the hall and I look over and she's looking up at, she's just, we're just walking, we're sort of looking at the posters and the things that are hung in the hallway. And she says, she goes, "I really like walking in halls now more than I used to." I'm like, she's a grade four. Like, you know, you have a grade four student that's saying they're liking something more than they used to. It's kind of a profound moment that they can have that type of reflective practice, right? I was like, "Oh yeah, well, why so?" And she says, "I can remember walking down this hall and the stuff on the walls," and she's pointing out the posters and all the adornments. "They used to just be posters on the walls." Like she said, they were like just, I knew they were letters, but I couldn't read the words. I saw the colors, but I didn't always understand the pictures. And she said, I didn't always know what the whole thing meant. She said, "But this year, I feel like I do. I feel like I can now," like she said, "I can't not read that poster now. And I can remember way back in the day." So this is where this, I'll wrap it back. But when I was in teacher's college, I had a prof for a session. It was one of the, when I was in teacher's college, I had 1% training in spec ed. So the space that I now inhabited for most of my career, I had one little sort of like taste of it, but I'll never forget the actual activity that we did. And the teacher was talking to us sort of, some sort of a lesson from the front of the room. And she told us to turn around and look at a poster at the back of the wall. And there was one poster there. I think I noticed the poster walking and I thought, well, that's kind of like, it was at OISE. So it was kind of one of their, like it was a space bigger than necessary considering the cohort that was in there. And we were all sort of facing away from this back wall. There was one poster there. And she was, I don't remember her name now. I wish I did. I wish I could attribute, but I can't. Prof at OISE, she said, could everyone turn around and look at the poster at the back of the wall? And everyone's looking at it. And she didn't say anything for a few minutes. And then she said, "Okay, I have some instructions for you. I would like you to try not to read it." So everyone's, you know, you kind of get mired in that one a little bit, like, try not to read it. So try to undo your fluencies. We've talked about fluencies before. And to undo a fluency is very difficult, very difficult. And we've often seen the unlearn, you know, the unlearn on the screens. Okay, maybe that we can save that for another podcast. But to actually extract your fluency when it came to reading for this crew, no one could actually do it. You could kind of put, you could use superficial tools, as in you could close your eyes, you could go into soft focus, you could sort of like avert your gaze, sort of like just look off to the side. So you're sort of looking at sideways so you couldn't read it. But when we look directly at it, you couldn't not read it. I couldn't do the activity because I could see, I could tell that, I could read that fluency. It's a poster on the wall. So that means it's the purpose there is embedded. There's words on a page. So it activates the, there's letters. They're different color than the background. There's a title. The fluencies were just kicking in, boom, one after another. And at some point it becomes overwhelming because I couldn't turn any of those off and I couldn't not read the poster. Except if I went into soft focus, closed my eyes, looked away. And I remember that that's what was sort of feeding into, well, that as well has really kind of anchored me in some of my thinking around spec ed and supporting spec ed. So it's kind of, it's got its roots in there. Then she said, because she told us to try to not do it. She goes, "I want you to imagine," excuse me, "a student that when they look at that poster, they can't access any of the tools that you have. So they are the person that you're trying to imagine yourself to be. They can't put those letters together. They can't understand or identify that that's a poster. They don't necessarily have easy access to the tools. That means we're going to read it from top left corner. you know, our sort of Western way of Western English, let's say English way of reading, top left corner to the right corner and down the page. And, you know, that got me thinking about some of the challenges that someone who learns differently might be faced with. I think my idea about this is going to stop just before the kind of cool idea that we need to support students that learn differently. I'm going to stop just before that. Because walking through the hallway with my daughter, she kind of identified with the strength of that fluency by saying, now these are no longer posters just around me. She goes, I understand why we put them in the hallway. I understand that I've put them in the hallway. And I also understand what's actually on the poster. I can read it. She's like, man, I really enjoy walking through these hallways now. Some of the work, I think, some of the work sometimes that I see posted up by my white colleagues kind of forgets that everybody sees the fluency that they're operating from. And some of the conversations that I've been in where I've tried to bring that perspective back into that, yes, I see that this makes you feel good to do this work. Yes, I see that you were there and you did some of the work. Yes, I see that you're sharing it out, hoping to maybe promote more work. But I also see yes in doing so, you're promoting yourself. Yes, I also see that you haven't attributed well to the source of your growth. Walking through the hallways with my daughter, she also said, I know that person on that poster. I was in class with that person. I know what that means because that, you know, an anti-bullying poster. I know what that means because that was something we worked on in class with my teacher. So she's attributing everywhere. She enjoys the fruits of the labor, as you kind of pointed out, but she's making sure that she's kind of pointing out she's not the source. She's not the source of her new understanding. Other people are. Other people have fed into that. And where I started this, I think if we had only stopped as I was walking with my daughter, if I had only stopped or she had only stopped at feeling good because she can do a thing now, and we never had the conversation around what's feeling that good and making sure that you feeling good, we're not going to spend much time on the fact that you understand where that knowledge came from and what the process was, that's a more important space to be. And I think sometimes when I look at some of the white folk feeds that I have, they're focusing more on the fact about how their growth makes them feel good, not on the attribution for where the information came from, not on the impact of packaging and reiterating someone else's learning, which even if they don't say it, by promoting it within that I'm accidentally white privileged learning space, you are saying that you own part of that knowledge when in fact someone else planted it in you. And for one of the things that I struggle with in a good way, because it slows me down long enough to notice how ridiculous my thinking is and how I might be engaging in that path of self-promotion over attribution, I realize that that's not for me to, it's not for me to, if I feel good about it, I don't know if I'm going to tell anyone. Because really, I don't think it matters. I really don't think that matters for me to feel good. If someone else feels good by my actions and they choose to share it with me, I'll take that as a roll of the dice. Because I think it's dangerous to get addicted to having people tell you you're doing a good job of being an anti-racist, either in words or their actions. Someone puts up a post on social media where they just said, you know, they quote from a conference they were at, and that quote is a direct lift from a person of color's book or their their lecture, and a bunch of people like that, I think you have an obligation always, always to make sure that their gaze is not centered on you if it's not your work. And the moment that someone says, you know, likes your thing, and this is where the algorithm messes with your brain, you get 1,000 likes on a quote that you sort of like push out from a conference you're at, and you don't actually put the person's name that said the quote on it, they're not liking the quote. They're liking you. Either way, you can't tell the difference. You can't tell the difference if they're liking you or liking the quote. You do know they're liking you if they say, thank you for posting this quote. Thank you for posting this quote. You do know they're liking you if they tell you, I appreciate you and all the work that you're doing. They are thanking you. And I think we have to be cautious. We have to be cautious. Because that's definitely a way where some, you know, you don't get to be accidentally white when you're gaining the privilege of that fruit. That was long. I was working through my thinking. What'd you get from it? Anything?
No, I got absolutely nothing.
Clough, you know, it'd be awesome. Clough, can you just go back to that first thing you said? I was like, no, I don't think I can.
I found it fascinating. I'm going to drill down a little bit. I found it fascinating what your daughter said about noticing the posters in the hallway. And it reminded me of the good old days when I used to work in a brick and mortar school. When I would walk up and down the halls in like rushing to get from one place to another. And I would see the colors and I would see the work on the walls and I'd see the bulletin boards, but I never really read what was on them. Isn't that also interesting? So your experience of being told, turn around, look at the poster, but don't read it. And then none of you can do that. There are moments where you can get into that zone when you're singly focused on one thing and you're marching around an area where there's stuff all over the place and you just don't notice any of it because that's not your focus. So the moment that that instructor brought focus to that poster, that's what, in my opinion, messed with all of you. Mm-hmm. I'm sure maybe there were many times you'd walk into that class, the poster's on the wall, and you didn't even know it was there because that wasn't your focus. So I thought that was interesting how your daughter's, from my worldview, your daughter's focus had shifted to, hey, look at all these things on the walls. And look, at this one means this, and this one came from here, and that one came from this person's idea. Like, it's wonderful when those things happen. It's wonderful when it happens on your terms, as opposed to somebody telling you, hey, look at that, but don't read it. Then you're like, oh man, I'm so in trouble here, right? I can't do that. It's very hard. It's very hard to do that. So no, and then at the end, the tweet thing, I never thought of it that way. I never thought of it that way. And I'm guilty of having done that, of having quoted people and then not given them direct. I don't know. I think it's maybe I start the first tweet is I'm listening to Chris Clough talk and I'm going to be tweeting out stuff that he says. And then I do it because in the thread at the top, you were attributed. And then I wasn't going to attribute you every single time. I was just going to refer to that one. Who knows? But I get what you're saying. I totally get
that's different too. I think fundamentally, you know, because, you know, I'm also not your one white friend.
I've got lots of white friends.
You've got lights. I know you've told me that. I'm a little jealous that I can't be, you know, your one white friend. But the, I think part of the truth as well is that, you know, an attribution, like what you do to sort of say, yeah, I'm in a conversation with Clough and he just said this thing. Sure, that's purposeful. I think that's purposeful. I think it's productive. I think it's also generative, isn't it? If I see that, I think to myself, okay, he's talking with me and about me. So he's including me in some of his thinking. And I do appreciate that. And to do it on every single one, that's, well, I don't know. I don't know how it would feel if you did that every single time. Still talking with Clef. Still in the podcast. You know what I mean? Like, it's just to kind of keep, you know, pushing it out that way. I think at some point I'm like, I'm good with one. Well, I'm good with one. But I'm talking about where there isn't even one. Not only is there not even one, it's codified in a way that it's just an extraction. It's just an extraction. And I mentioned to you about a poem that I'm working on, about Amanda's poem that she did during the inauguration, and sort of trying to find a way through my words about my experience of hearing that poem, but also where my thoughts go to as I experienced her poem, and realizing that in the poem, some of my thoughts that are popping up are deeply, deeply connected with the amount of content that popped up on. So I'm writing this poem, I'm thinking about the pieces, and I'm sort of, the poem in some ways has a few moments in it. It's like, don't do this, don't do this. And the things I'm talking about, don't do this, started to pop up on social media where people are posting lesson plans about it. People are breaking down the experience into kind of like a multi-step analysis. And there's always a whole lot of content being posted about it. Now, I'm still kind of working through my thoughts on that. But my concern in general is what happens to the art, the artist, and our understanding in that relationship when we disembody the art from the artist. And I get that we do that in order to personalize it. Like, if you read a book, at some point, you do personalize it in your ego. You're like, you're reflecting inwardly, not necessarily still thinking about why that person created that piece of art. I think it can kind of go both ways, right? Like, you can just have the emotional response. You can have the emotional response, but you can also have a very logical response to it. And I think that's where I saw a quicker shift. I didn't see or didn't find, now this could also be a problem with my privileged learning network, my PLN, that I haven't connected with enough people that will sort of help me to see that there's another way. So that's work that I'm still doing. How do I sort of make sure that I'm getting the best, most robust view on the world that's happening out there, so I don't start to think that my one little picture in picture is the only thing going on, right? I don't want that with my social media. I want the challenge that's brought by having a diverse network of people for me to learn from. My current network and some of the stuff that was popping up in my network, not even necessarily people, here's the thing, not necessarily people that I'm following, but you know the way Twitter works. When somebody likes something, that thing gets posted onto your feed, right? So-and-so just liked this, or so-and-so just followed this. Do you want to follow them too? The amount of content that I saw popping up that, to me, I guess, as a, where it hit my anti-racist alarm was the number of posts for content that was being generated that disembodied Amanda's poem from her. And I mean that in so much as it seemed to center some of the lessons, and the ones that bothered me the most seemed to center on the reader's experience more than the story that led up to her writing that poem. And that's a process. And I interacted with someone on my PLN saying, well, isn't that kind of the process that we work through? Is that in order to get to the good questions, we have to start with the reader's response, the reader's emotional state. I guess, but I had a sense of pain that I think I felt just as an artist. And it was reinforced by what looked like quick step learning through a lesson plan about a poem that's anchored in, it's anchored in hundreds of years of information, right? The story is anchored in something far broader than that moment. Yeah, that goes back to the attribution again. That goes back to the attribution point again. But if you want to, you know, connect me to every single one of your tweets that you think, I should know about, that would be interesting. That'd be an interesting process. Spend a week. Every single tweet that you pop out that you think I might have a connection to, I'll do the same for you.
I don't know if I'll be able to make that commitment.
No.
So I thought that this is an interesting moment, you know, where people say, well, why don't you do this? And then the person opposing them doesn't say no. I'm saying to you, I don't think I can make a commitment to this. So just so you know, right. It happens at school a lot. You're in a meeting and somebody says, oh, Roland, can you just da 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 da? And you think to yourself, no, it's not happening, but you don't say it. Right. Yeah. Depending on who you're talking to or the situation you're in, the context you're in. Can I shift gears just a little bit?
Do it.
Maybe a lot. I was in a meeting yesterday about one of my students who's moving. And so my student is moving, and my student has some needs. And so school staff on my end met with school staff on their end to, and we've done, this wasn't the first meeting. This was just, yesterday was my student's last day with me. And we wanted to see if we could get the student to come and do a Google meeting, to see the new people that, he's going to be working with the old people there saying, hey, these are your new friends and we're friends too. So let's wish you luck and have a good one. And unfortunately the student was not able to attend because of technical issues, but I had an interesting digital virtual teaching moment yesterday at the end of the school day. I removed this student from my Google Classroom. I've never had to remove a student from my classroom. They move, they pick up, they get their stuff. We say goodbye. The bell rings, they leave the brick and mortar school. And then on Monday, they don't come back to the brick and mortar school. That's normal. I've had that happen a zillion times. It'll probably happen a zillion more in my career. But this was the first time for me that I had a student leave my classroom as I taught virtually. And if we can layer this a little, and it was weird, like the moment where I clicked on this, I selected this person's name and clicked remove, it was just a weird moment that I was fully aware of. Like it was on my mind all day that this is what I was going to do at the end of this day. And I did it, and I just felt so weird doing it. Now, here are some layers.
Yeah, because I was wondering if you could be less abstract.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and trust me, I'm not being abstract on purpose. I'm not sure what words to use, to be honest with you, and to make a long story short.
Nice.
Yeah, you like that? I get two points there, right?
Two points.
I don't know how to say it. Okay, so here are the layers. It seems like I did some research, I did some thinking last night. Every time we would bump up against a long weekend or a holiday, I instinctively felt like I needed to wish this student well until I see them again. The day before we end school to go on the long weekend or the holiday. So this child never seems to be present on those transition days, the Fridays, really. For whatever reason, they're not there. And I had a feeling I had a feeling at Christmas, and I had a feeling yesterday. I had a feeling approaching Christmas that the day before we left for Christmas break, the child probably wouldn't be in my presence. So whatever I needed to say to the child or tell the child to prepare for after Christmas needed to be done ahead of schedule. And it would make people look at me like, why are you doing that? Why are you talking about that now? You can talk about that then. I'm like, there is no then. This child is never there for the then, for whatever reason, the universe doesn't allow for it. And so before Christmas, on the Thursday, I said to the student, I had something for the student. So I gave it to him and I said, hey, Merry Christmas. And he even looked at me and said, why are you giving this to me today?
Yeah.
I said, I got a vibe. I should give it to you today in case I don't see you tomorrow. And he's like, are you not coming to school tomorrow? I'm like, I'm fully preparing to come to school, planning on it. The next day comes, guess who's not at school? The kid. And I got this vibe too, that yesterday was going to be his last day. We knew that for a couple of weeks. And so on Wednesday, he said to me, hey, I want to tell you something. I said, yeah, I want to tell you something too. And then he asked about some items that were in the classroom before Christmas that he wasn't able to get because he wasn't there on the Friday. And I said, yeah, I've got those items. Don't worry. Once you move and you get settled, I'll bring them over to your place. I'll drive over and I'll put them on the front porch, ring the doorbell, and you'll come out and grab them and you'll have them. You say, okay, thank you. I think it was stressing him out a little bit. And then guess what? Yesterday he was nowhere to be found. And yesterday when we had this meeting that was built for him, he wasn't able, his computer was causing him difficulties. He was not able to log into the Google Meet. So I think those layers and the relationship that was built with this student because of his needs, it all just was like sitting in front of me yesterday, literally at, I don't know, 3:52 p.m. before I shut everything down, went downstairs. I went to the Google Classroom. I selected his name and I removed him from my class. And it was weird. Because of the whole virtual thing and because of we built a relationship face to face and then we moved it into the online world. And now he's gone to another school where he's, you know, I'm sure for the new teacher, I can't speak for her, but I'm sure it might be a little bit strange to click some buttons and have somebody just magically appear into your classroom. I don't know. I think for me, it's the face to face relationship and all the layers of understanding this child's needs and working to meet the needs. I put in more than 100%, and now it's gone from 100% to just zero. So there's probably some feelings of like withdrawal in a weird way. I don't know. I don't know what to say. I just wanted to share that strange feeling of removing a student from the classroom instantly. Like, and one of the, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, maybe it could have been done in a week or two, right? But one of the reasons why it had to happen yesterday was because this child is a relationship person. You know, I said to my principal the day before, I said, how do you want me to deal with this? Because he's no longer my student, he may decide to come into our Google Meets with my class and maybe run amok or maybe just come in and out as he pleases. Now, I set my controls, my host controls, so that you can't come into my classroom meetings unless I admit you, right? So you click on it, I get a notification, will you admit this person? So I probably would not admit him, but I wanted to make it clear to my boss that, hey, listen, like, you know, we built a relationship. He may come looking to hang or to talk or whatever. And I think in a brick and mortar situation, we wouldn't just let the kid walk into the building halfway through the day, walk up the stairs and be like, hey, what's going on? I'm back, you know? And so my boss said, no, no, with this, in this situation, reach out to the student, let him know that he can always send you an email or whatever, which I couldn't even do because the student didn't come to class.
Mm-hmm.
Let him know. Well, I couldn't, it didn't work. So, all those layers on top of layers, but I will see him when he's settled in his new place. I will go and, you know, do the ring the doorbell and stand 3 or 4 feet back. Door opens. What's going on? There's your stuff. Hope all is well. Take care.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to drop that. Man, that was weird.
I've seen some of this from a different perspective. Yesterday, as the kids were filing out of my two sections, so doing the learning strategies, we were talking about one student asked flat out, like, sir, do I keep, so grade 9 learning strategies, high school, for anyone listening in, said, do I have to keep all the Google Classrooms that I'm enrolled in right now? Like, because there's, for some of them, it's a management issue. They're just like, I don't want to have extra classrooms around there. Like, they're not playing into anything other than, you know, that awesome energy of, can I leave class now, sir? Right. So that idea of, because yesterday was the last day of our semester. So we're going into semester 2. A unnatural transition moment in human terms, that you're no longer going to see a person just because of a deadline. Like, that's an unnatural one, right? Like school imposed deadline. But it happens, and we sort of go on, and in the reinforcement of, you know, we're still going to be working together because you're a part of my crew and my caseload. We're still going to be doing work together. But it was interesting because I said to the student, I'm like, you don't have to. You don't have to keep those old classrooms. You can get rid of those classrooms if you want. I asked, please keep our classroom because it's going to be our way to communicate when I'm doing resourcing next semester. So I asked them to keep it, please. And one of the students said, I'm still in all of my classrooms all the way back into elementary. Now, again, these are grade 9 students. So the grade 9 students, they haven't been out of elementary all that long. They haven't, right? But they were really kind of looking at it from, this one student was looking from a nostalgic point of view. They were saying, I'd like to go back and kind of just spend time with my teacher. Like, they were saying, I'd like to be back in that space. There's just something about being back there that I appreciate. Now, this is the equivalent, I think, in some ways, of the in real life phenomenon of students kind of coming back to visit. And in secondary, we see this, that often when someone graduates or when they go to university or whatever their post at college, workplace, wherever their pathway is, that first year just after high school, often students in the past would have come back and they'll come back and visit. And they're still kind of closer to the version of the grade 12 student, remember, than the adult version that you might never meet because they're going to go off in their life. But definitely once they make it into second year university or, you know, year 2 of their job, or they might be starting a family, all these, once they've sort of grounded themselves in the next pathway, they tend not to come back and visit. Then you just have that random thing where you're out in the grocery store one day and you're like, someone goes, Clough? And I'm like, you from, you know, kind of drinking through 7 years, like the multi-year of like, I know what I did. I taught you. And they're like, oh, I love the hospital. So you get the memories out. Hospitality class, whatever it is, wherever we met. So this question around how are we closing up shop and how are we welcoming and transitioning students in and out of our digital classrooms, I think is a powerful, it has powerful reflective potential, I think, for instructors. And I would love to hear more stories of people as they're soaking in that emotional moment and the complications that happen in that moment. Like, even yesterday, as I was in one section of the class, when we're it's amazing how certain things are so triggering. In the last few minutes, I always, so the basically the procedure, one of the things I say at the end of the class is when we get to the last few minutes of the class, the students are allowed to work away from the Google Classroom. They can take it as independent time. So there's sort of a chunk right at the end of what the actual class time is. So I'm sure every, well, I won't say sure, but I sort of got into a pattern of how I said it. I was like, hello, folks, whether I was sort of talking at the time or they were working on something, like, okay, folks, now's the time where you are welcome to work away from the Google Classroom. I want you all to play safe and stay safe. I'll be staying in the classroom for the next 10 minutes if anyone needs support. If not, I'll see you tomorrow. And that was the pattern. That was my closer. And I just got into a groove. I would always, always say that. Yesterday, dude, I started to choke up. I kind of paused partway through it. And I wish, this is what I'll show you. So this is, as I'm sort of choking some of the motions, I kind of looked down from my camera and I just wrote that. So I put that up in front of the camera and I was just like, mute my mic. And I'm just like, cause it, like I'm that transition. Like I haven't seen too many posts about this, about some of the feels. And it was the other part to this. I'll just connect this one last little bit. When we were face-to-face, so on my board's in an adaptive model. So what that meant was we were doing one period, one block in the morning that was face-to-face, and then everyone went home to do online. And then the face-to-face block, different courses rotated through it. So what that meant was, for me, I went 6 weeks before having face-to-face time with my students again. And every single time that the face-to-face session walked out the door, I'm going through the emotional moments of this is like the last day of school and having invested really intense time with the students and really enjoying spending time with the students. So this whole thing about the complicated feels about actually removing a student from the class, I think because it's intentional, but it's also artificial to a way, right? You don't do anything at the end of the school year normally to declare you're not going to interact with that kid on the first day of their summer holidays. You don't say to them, there's no point and click to close that relationship. The kids leave the class, they go off, and everyone just accepts that's not something we're not going to talk about. You might say something like, see you in September. But you don't say, don't call me on Monday because it's summer holiday. But that's what that point and click is like. Click, we're done. And I think it flies in the face of the relationships. There is no done.
you just explained it perfectly for me. So what's happening is, for me, the online virtual culture is banging up against the brick and mortar school culture. There's different cultures. Mm-hmm. There's different ways of operating. Some teachers are okay. They'll just leave the kid in their class. And then the kid has access to the classroom whenever they feel like it. Mm-hmm. This isn't going to work in this situation. It's not going to work. It's not good for the kid to have this open-ended. There, you know, there's a line. And you got to cut the cord. And like I said, I'll be seeing the kid in a couple of weeks. I'll be dropping stuff off at the place. So it's not like you're never going to see me again. It's just it wasn't able to work out at the end the way that people wanted it to work out at the end. That's all. And man, this student took a lot of our time. And I don't say that in a negative way. I just say there was a lot in – every student gets what they need. This student needed a lot, right? This student needed relationship. This student needed time. This student needed – it seemed like more from me than other students needed. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure somebody else will step up. Or I'll see things that I didn't see before now that this student is gone. And another thing, another hat tip to the universe, that when we started virtually, this child was not as present as he would have been in face-to-face because of the virtual culture. You know, because he could come and go as he pleased into the room, out of the room, due to his living situation. There are lots of factors that are eliminated once you walk into the brick and mortar school. And this is the thing, I wrote a tweet about this the other day. Somebody said, I can't attribute the tweet. I don't know who it was. I don't even remember exactly what they said. It was something like, what have you learned now? Or what are you more appreciative now in the virtual because of all this happening that you didn't get before? And my response was the power of having students literally in front of you in face-to-face brick and mortar school, the power of them leaving their homes and being dropped into a completely different environment than home with different expectations and rules and culture. I was told by a principal many years ago when I started my teaching career, I remember a situation where I was really bothered with my situation, and I was thinking about all the things that happens to my particular student when they leave the building. And my principal said to me, you have no control over what happens outside of here. You have total control of what happens here. So when the child is with you, exert that control and make awesome things happen. And let go of the, well, once they walk out the door, they act completely different. Let that go. You have no control over that. That is, again, if you use my terms around culture, that's the culture that this child belongs to outside of school. When the child is in school, they belong to the culture of your classroom, the culture of this school. Exert your control there so that you can make strides with the student, so the student can grow as a person, as a student. And I remember him telling me that, and I soaked it up. But now it's like I'm ultra sensitive to that. And this student that I'm talking about today completely fits with that whole notion. When that student was in the building with me, we could work on what I had control over and what he had control over, because he was empowered and he was given control. He was given power in ways that would feed him properly. But once he left, you know, when he would come into the room, you know, what are we doing? You know, and for me to say, well, where have you been for the last hour? That's not going to work with that student. I've done that with other students. Like, where have you been? Like, we started an hour ago. Where were you? And then there's the awkward silence of, well, you know, whatever they were doing, they weren't interested in school, but now they're in school. So he'd come in and what are we doing? And I would take him through it. And then I would kind of try to work with him as best as I could so I could gather some data from him to see what he gets, what he doesn't get, knowing that he's transient. He's just going to come and go as he pleases. So even like, I just, that appreciation for once they're in front of me again and there's nowhere for them to go and that's it. It is me. I'm going to truly appreciate that 100 times more than before, because even now I'm teaching and I can see the parents sitting beside the kids.
Yeah.
Like, that's stressful. You've got me barking in one ear and your mom's looking at you like, do your job. Why aren't you doing your schoolwork? How come you don't understand this? Right? It's like, it's dual. Actually, you'll appreciate this. Well, two things I want to say, and then I'm going to stop talking. The first one is, yesterday, my vice principal came into my classroom for my last period of synchronous time with my kids. We were having a classroom meeting, okay? So we started at 1:40, and I'm doing my meet with the class, is doing the meeting. We're going through what we do for our classroom meetings. And 20 minutes later, two kids walk in. And they're like, what's going on? And I did one of these. I looked at my vice principal and I'm like, this is what you need to see and hear. So I look at the kid and I'm like, we started 20 minutes ago. You've missed half the period. Where were you? I get nothing. I'm like, is this a joke? Like, where were you 20 minutes ago? You had a 15-minute recess, then you were supposed to come back. So you've had a 35 minute recess and you walk in and you're like, what's going on? Can't you see what's going on? Haven't I taught you to turn off your microphone and to listen and to look around? Like, I'm kind of giving these kids the gears, but I'm like, hey, vice principal, do you see what's happening here? This is what we're dealing with every day. And I'm not, my vice principal's not, you know, hammering on me. Okay. She's not coming at me in a negative way, but I'm like, this is good for you to see because we're in the middle of something here. We were in the middle of some good stuff too, building kids up, talking mental health, getting them ready for the weekend. And these kids just walk in, they're like, what's going on? And I'm like, well, when you walk in 20 minutes late all day long every time, I have no control over that. I can't control that. Once they're with me in the building, they're with me in the building, right? We can say, get in here, recess is over, or get outside, recess is starting. I can't do that in the virtual world. I can try, but I tell you right now, it doesn't work. Some of them just come and go as they please. That was the first thing I want to say. So my vice principal got to see it, which was awesome. I'm sure she already knows, but it's always better for them to actually see what's happening. And then the second thing was, this one student was working. He was on the floor in front of his computer and his dad was behind him playing his guitar. And we were writing. It was a writing moment. And I said to the kid, hey, if you don't mind, turn on your microphone and let's listen to your dad play some guitar while we work. He's like, okay, turns it on. It was pretty cool. For about 5 to 8 minutes, people were working and we were listening to the dad just play these cool like little tunes, you know, nice and easy, no problem. And then later on in the day, the kid raised his digital hand. And because I'm sharing my screen and I'm using two screens, I'm looking around and I finally get back to the hands and I'm like, oh, so-and-so, I see your hand is raised. Go ahead and turn on your microphone and speak. I got nothing. I can see the camera. There's no kid in front of the computer, but I can see the dad in the back of the room kind of working. So I'm like, so-and-so, are you there? And the dad comes right up to the camera, gets down on the floor, looks in the camera, turns on the mic and says, did you want so-and-so? And I'm like, yeah. He goes, what's up? I said, well, he raised his hand. So I would like to address his question or his comment. Okay, hold on. And he yells for his kid. So-and-so, get up here. The kid's like, why? He goes, your teacher's calling you. And I'm like, in what world do we live in where the dad walks into the classroom and starts chatting me up, telling him to get back to class. Your teacher needs you now. And it was funny. The dad was friendly, but the dad was like, well, what do you want? I'm like, we're in the middle of class. What do you mean? What do I want? He's supposed to be in front of me learning. So it's these moments that are helping me with the levity. I'm starting to lighten up because I'm like, anybody who's not a moron can see that there's things happening that's out of a teacher's control. And there's just nothing the teacher can do about it. I can't tell the dad, hey, stay off the call. You're not supposed to be in my classroom. I mean, I could, but that's not going to help anybody's relationship building. And this kid getting up and doing what he wants, whatever he wants, just leaving class. Well, I mean, it's these things that it's the WTF moments. Like, what is going on here? This never would happen in brick and mortar. We're not in brick and mortar. So please, to the people above me, don't pretend like everything is just going along smoothly. It's not. I got kids walking in 20 minutes late. I got kids walking out 20 minutes early. I got parents coming in and checking in, see what's going on. I got parents sitting beside their kids, basically stressing their kids out because I'm stressing their kid out, right? It's like, it's just wacky. It's out of this world, whack job type stuff. So I show up for class. I teach my lessons. I push back. I ask where people have been. I mean, I can always call their parents or email their parents, but okay. Like, yeah, I can do that, but it's not the same as saying to the kid, this needs to get done and you're not doing anything else until it gets done. So have a seat in front of me and what do we need to do to make it happen? In this digital world, it's just different. It's different.
Can I share one thing?
Share your one thing, Chris.
Here's my one thing. I can remember back, it was back when I was still doing, Alt Ed. And one of the things that happened often when I was, at a staff meeting and we were talking about like assessment and evaluation and like board-based initiatives would be coming through, and I'd be sitting with my crew, other sort of alt ed teachers, and often I felt like the, initiative happened, it happened quite a bit, but general initiatives that the board is suggesting that whole school should engage with, sometimes I felt that it didn't really, see my alt ed context. Like it wasn't written in a way that it took into account the realities of the alt ed context. And I mean, you could argue that from when it's a board-based initiative, you could argue that for almost any department, that it's kind of written in a generalized way where you have to adapt up from where you are in your authentic learning space in order to sort of really like draw down what the board's expectation was. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Sorry, it always worked because sometimes because it had to. It didn't always work well. That idea of, you know, one of the questions that I put in one of these board initiatives, we were talking about assessment and evaluation and trying to become more consistent. So they were sort of talking within departments, how consistent is your A&E policy across like one course? And then how is it also consistent across your courses within your department? And then we were talking about ways to increase consistency. And I think when I heard increase consistency, I was still kind of sitting on the, well, where are we drawing our information from? Like, where are we drawing our information? Like, what's our data pools to suggest that the consistency that we're looking for is the consistency that the kids need and that our families within our learning community would understand? And in one of my, they had us all divided up. So it was sort of me sitting with, well, it was all different teacher, all different departments, you know, they did the kind of jigsaw kind of tabling. And I put to the table, I said, what would happen if we included parents in our lesson plan design? As in, we spent intentional time talking with parents about how we could better work with kids, their kid, of course, but kids in general. So we actively solicit the advice of parents. And there was a lot of, that was not a liked, that did not get a lot of likes. And for reasons that are fairly straightforward, they said be complicated, you know, the logistics of having that conversation were already overworked. But then there were some other interesting moments as in, what do they know about education? They're not trained to do my content area. I've spent 10 years on this. So there was the more ego-centered kind of responses. I like the logistical ones because logistical ones, I feel like they're more that when you talk about the logistics, it feels like we're more talking about the problem between us, not the problem with us. And if you can keep it the problem between you and you work out the logistics, then you find yourself in the space of having these conversations. But they were kind of shutting down participation in the conversation in the first place. I almost feel like we're back in the space, like that was 10 years ago when I had that conversation. I feel like we're in a space right now where we've kind of just time warped into the reality of not being able to design our lessons anymore without taking into account the whole family needs. We've talked about now we're in their living rooms. We are actively in these little humans' houses. We can say that we're being piped in, but we're there. We're getting almost all of the experience. The fact that dad's playing the guitar for your, like, if you've never had one of the fathers ever play music for your classroom, this is a transformative moment, especially because you didn't go through the sort of like chain of thinking of checking in with the principal ahead of time, you know, going through the field trip, privacy and safety things ahead of time. You have an event, a live event. This is what sort of I think a really interesting time for. I'm gonna label it pop-up pedagogy. Yo, it's pop-up pedagogy because you're being you're confronted with an opportunity that you have to decide, like you're confronted with the sort of tension of, is this an opportunity or is this something that I need to control? And I'm not talking about, let's say, a student's bad behavior where they're filling the chat or they're hand up, or they're putting a gift. Like, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about where there is an actual learning opportunity happening there that previously we would have had to ask permission for. This data is sitting there. If all kids are up and the kid, like, we've accepted the fact that the kid, that the parent or someone else in the house is watching us teach. You have to get a police check for that. A year ago, you have to get a police check to be able to come in the school and see what the classroom looks like, to just to be able to walk in, right? You don't make it past the office. The office doesn't exist anymore in some of these digital pop-up pedagogical processes. I can only imagine. Well, I'm going to imagine because I wonder if they're even happening, but I'm also imagining because I don't even know what their access point would be for this. But for upper leadership right now, it makes me wonder if they're having conversations around what are the implications here? The fact that almost every day some classes are going on a field trip because the kids that are on the other end of the camera are working out in their backyard, or they're up at their cottage, or some kids are out walking with their device and they're doing class. We were in we had a staff event the other night on Thursday, just to get together. You know, we played some trivia, had some drinks, some jokes. It was great. One of the individuals in the staff get together was on his phone and he was on a hike. And at the time I'm like, that, well, we see that, you know, tons of our privileged learning network will post up a video of them out on a walk. Tons of them will. But I had this moment, like, that's what students are doing too. I had a kid that was, I could hear his skateboard going in the background. And I could see from the chat that there were two instances of his account up. So that means the laptop's in the house and he's out somewhere riding a skateboard, but staying in class. So we have these constant pop-up opportunities that are game changers. They're game changers. It will be interest, and the fact that we're not talking about it does mean that certain powers are accepting that it's happening. You know, one of our colleagues says, you know, you promote what you permit. I don't know if it's that black and white. I don't know if it's that high contrast, that yes, no, the one or the zero, but there's something to that, eh? That there's stuff happening in the classrooms that a year ago, the paperwork and bureaucracy to get to that moment would have been a fat stack.
100%. What I didn't even think of it in the way that you presented it. I mean, when the father played the guitar, he wasn't even, I could just see on the video, I could see that he was sitting on a stool and I could see the guitar, right? I couldn't see the person and he couldn't see us. I could just see him playing. And so when he played the guitar, it was just, hey, unmute your mic, let us hear it. But when he came to the camera and he looked directly into it, that means that he could see everybody else in the room and where they were if their cameras were on. And you're right, that would never happen. If I wanted a parent to come in and play music for my class or even to look at us, I would need to fill out papers and talk to my administrators and make sure it was all legit, you know?
And how casual did it feel? Did it feel pretty casual? Like, okay, cool. Like, apart from the, your child needs to be here, did it also in some ways seem like this is how we interact now?
Well, I thought nothing of unmute your mic and let's listen to the music. I thought nothing of that. But when he came to the camera and looked into it and asked me what I wanted, that felt like a violation.
There was an intrusion. Like, it felt, yes, a little bit like an intrusion.
That I felt like, we just stepped over a line here that we shouldn't be stepping over. And I imagine from his perspective, he'd simply be like, whoa, I wasn't invading you. I heard you talking, so I wanted to know. You know, I think what he could have done is just told his kid, hey, get up here. Your teacher's calling you. There was no reason to he didn't have to unmute the mic and get his face on the camera and all that.
He could have argued too that you were intruding in his world.
I guess he could have.
Yeah.
My response to that though would be, hey, I'm teaching, and that's the device your kid's using is like, I'm teaching. I'm supposed to be teaching, but you're not supposed to be in my classroom right now.
Yeah.
So I get what you're saying, and I would get his perspective. I would
say that's the space for him, though. That's all it is. I get it.
I'd say that's a conversation you have with your son about where he's supposed to have his computer when he's in school. Because yeah, I'm talking. I'm not going to stop talking. I got to teach.
Yep.
Anyway, no, that was good. Thanks for sharing that.
I've had parents in the background, and I hear it. Ask Clough about this. And they've asked the question. Ask Clough about the IEPs. I'm like, I can address that. And I know I'm on open mic, and from the background I hear, thanks. So they're sitting there, they're interacting with the classes. You know, I've heard other family members, like there's a whole, yeah. It's the space that we're in. And the not talking about it doesn't mean that big changes are happening to public education. To look directly at it is sometimes tricky, because I think still some teachers are, I wonder if some teachers are still a little worried. Oh, a parent was in my Google Meet today. Like, they wonder if that's okay. I noticed something when a kid was on video, what do I do? Like, all these, it's really heady stuff that now that we're firmly sitting there on the, you know, the sofa beside the kid. And what we have access to. I've told you before, I've heard meals being cooked. I've heard, you know, people coughing. I've seen sort of long views of where the laptop is just kind of sat on the couch and it's watching TV. So all of a sudden you're like, well, the kid was obviously sitting on the couch and now has gone to the bathroom. Like, they do the be right back in the chat, but they don't turn off their camera and they set their laptop down, and then the laptop is like facing the TV. So it's... I can remove them, but I can't turn off their camera. So in class, you know, we're watching some TV show. It's slightly out of phase, but you know, we're looking at a TV.
I'm guilty of participating in some of the shenanigans. Like, the one day, this one student was working, and she was, the behavior wasn't good, and her lack of work also was not. Like, it just wasn't a good situation. So, and here's the thing too, all the parents can hear what I'm saying if they want to, right? So they hear me teach, they hear me discipline, they hear me praise, they hear it all. And this one kid, I don't know, was giving me some lip, and the mom was standing right behind the kid with her hands on her hips, and the look on the mom's face was very unimpressed with the kid. And as I'm talking to the kid's giving me every excuse. And I said, hey, listen, you know what? As disappointed as I am right now in your behavior, I don't think it's going to be as bad as what your mom's going to feel when she finds out what's going on here. And the kid's like, why would my mom know? And I'm like, because she's standing right behind you. And the kid was like, the kid did one of these. Looks behind her, sees her mom like this.
Yeah, then, I've had that too.
And then I see the mic gets muted and the camera goes off. And I was just like, I just did one of these. I'm like, kids, what do you want me to do? If I see you acting a certain way that's not appropriate for school, I'm going to tell you to stop. That's my job. And I know you're sitting, I'm telling the kids, hey, don't eat around the Chromebook. And as I'm saying it, there's this kid with the biggest bowl of cereal, walks into the frame, puts it right down in front of the computer, and is literally going to town, milk going everywhere. And I'm like, didn't we just talk about Chromebook care and safety? Like, it's just all kinds of stuff, right? Anyway, unless you have something pressing to say, this was season 4, episode 21 of the Decode Podcast. Yeah, I saw you painting today. There are people sitting in a crowd, and some of them are in focus and some of them are not. Can you explain that to me?
I don't know. I think I was just taking inspiration from the privileged PLN.
Oh, yes, the Privileged Learning Network.
Privileged Learning. Yeah, the I like that. We're only the fourth person to use, fourth group to play with that pop-up pedagogy hashtag. Mm-hmm. But let's rock that one. I think it works. And the Privileged PLN, Privileged Learning Network. That's
crazy.
Well, it's a thing.
Well, have a good one, Chris.
You too. You too, man. Thanks for the convo. Peace. Oh, yeah. What was this? Season 4, episode 21. I get to be Chris J. Clough, and he gets to be Roland Chidiac every week almost. Decoding Saturdays on Decoded Podcast. There's the bumper. Nailed it.
Thanks for being one of my white friends.